Back together again, you and I chatting it up midweek Wednesday style, March 11th, 2026 on Connecticut Today, where we welcomed Hearst Connecticut Media's Dan Haar to recap a very busy, high-pressure day with plenty of emotional public testimony at the state capitol on some controversial bills. Columnist and blogger Chris Powell dropped by earlier in the show to discuss Connecticut education and school funding. I had a few thoughts on a push to further regulate homeschooling in Connecticut. And CBS News military analyst, retired Colonel Jeff McCausland, explained in great detail the current battle situation in the Middle East.
Ah, busy, busy day at the state capitol. A lot of emotional public testimony up there. Some highly charged bills. I haven't used highly charged in a while. There you go. Check that one off the list. Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Media senior editor and columnist, stopping by for his usual gander into all this. Hey, Dan, it's Paul. How are you, sir? What's up?
I was there. I was in the thick of it.
I was going to ask you, so what? We had the vaccine bill. I think we had the homeschooling bill. Now, the big thing, Dan, is the homeschooling forces. They were out in force, I think, last year or the year before. The majority say, listen, we just want to get a little framework of a bill in here. I know there was a lot of pushback on it. So tell my listeners what you saw and heard today.
Yeah, there are two levels going on. 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago or not long ago, whenever it was, it all blurs during the session. There was a hearing on a bill that would require homeschool parents to register or school districts to register that somebody has pulled their child from school in order to be homeschooled with the Department of Children and Families. And that was very controversial. Of course, that stemmed from the three tragedies over the last couple of years that we all know and were horrified by.
Yeah.
And that was controversial enough. But now this bill today is a whole big, long cavalcade of rules that even some people who are on the side of we favor regulation might say, now, wait a minute, this might be going a little too far.
Wow.
The argument from, and I heard from a person who's normally on the other side, who sort of, you know, sheepishly, we use the word sheepishly whenever there's a discussion, when a Democrat criticizes a bill, we always use the adverb sheepishly, right? Because God forbid it ever be uttered where anybody could hear that.
Yeah.
Right. But the point is that this person called it an unforced error because it really imposes a lot of regulation. You know, you have to file reports and it's seven parts. You have to file testing and reports and this and that. And it's sort of almost as if it's still under the State Department of Education, which in a narrow sense it is. Mm-hmm. But that's what has parents so upset, not just the registration. It's that fairly onerous set of regulations in respect to homeschooling that defeats, in the view of those who do it, the purpose of doing it.
And Dan, before we go to something else here, was there any concern in that bill, the fact that it's referred to as equivalent education or however they call it, that there would also be a perceived intrusion as to what a homeschooling parent would have to or be mandated to teach their kid or children? Anything on that or not?
Hands off my children, hands off my guns, hands off my body. Those were the three public hearings today. Education, homeschooling, the gun control bill, which is not so onerous, and the vaccine bill, which is the religious exemption. They were all of a piece. And there were some people upset that they did them all on the same day. You know, was that done purposefully? Mm-hmm. A friend of mine came who's an arch liberal and who's not normally at the Capitol. And I said, what are you doing here? And she was testifying in an altogether different bill. I said, okay.
Wow. Before we get to Linda McMahon, part two, Dan, there's been a lot of discussion here on the station, and my listeners and listeners to other programs here are a little confused, and I know you've covered this about as well as anybody else, this whole Aquarian thing and the perceived flip-flop by Pura. Can you please give us a bite-sized version of what happened?
Well, it's not a flip-flop by Pura. Pura carried out the wishes of the court. The court sent the case back to Pura with a very narrow set of instructions to remind the listeners, on November 19th, Pura rejected the merger on the grounds that the governance wasn't right for them. And the legislature had exactly spelled out that governance, and therefore Judge Matthew Budzik in New Britain, who usually does preside, often presides over Pura cases, said, no, you can't reject something that the state legislature spelled out. You can only look at it narrowly in terms of something called the Office of Consumer Advocate. And that's it. And so Pura didn't, I mean, yes, they reversed themselves, but they didn't do so voluntarily. They did so following the law. Unfortunately, Attorney General Tong and 25 towns and some other legislative leaders wanted Pura to reverse itself and reject. That would be reverse the judge and reject. But Pura didn't do that.
So basically they had, Dan, no legal way out of, so they had to do with what the judge told them.
I'm not a lawyer, but I read the decision, and Judge Budzik is a pretty good writer, as it happens. Mm-hmm. Not all of them are, and it was very clear. Mm-hmm. It was very clear. And so, but of course, it's the law. And so Attorney General Tong, as well as Jonathan Steinberg from Westport and others in the legislature and in the COGS, believe that no, Pura did have jurisdiction. The bill that's in the legislature right now is precisely to go back and give Pura the ability to rule on governance. That is, that Jonathan Steinberg is of the opinion, and others in that dislike the merger, that when we passed this bill and set up this governance, we were saying to Pura, if you approve this governance, then this is the way it should be. And the way it got interpreted was, this is the governance. And it all came down to three words, so as always these cases do.
All right. And finally, I kind of sighed when I saw this story that the education secretary, lover or hater, that's not the point, Linda McMahon, her appearance now has been rejected at another Connecticut school here mere weeks after it happened at an elementary school in Fairfield County. I remember that time we talked about it. You didn't think that was a good look. What about this go around?
I think this one is just madness. Because if the first, you know, fool me once, shame on me. If the first time around, the school district, in that case, Fairfield, accepted and invited her, whether you could say they invited her is a different question, but brought her in and allowed her to come, and then due to an uproar, rescinded that offer. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. But this time around, knowing that that had happened to these people in it's Thomaston, right?
Yeah.
Did they not read all the coverage? I'm like, did they not, like, what was going through their minds when they did exactly the same thing that Fairfield did, and they didn't announce it until two nights before, and then all of a sudden there was an uproar? Well, cut off my legs and call me Shorty. Why didn't they think of that to begin with? Shame on the town this time.
And as you said, Dan, I wonder if you think the same thing the first time, and I've had a couple of virulent anti-Trump people call me in and say, good. But in a roundabout way, this kind, and I know you said it the first time, feeds into an image that a lot of the Republicans want to falsely create about people, about intolerance.
Well, like, this is exactly analogous to the Democrats running a 15-part bill, a 96-section 15 bill omnibus, with some of it without public hearings, all of it under the guise of an emergency. That takes away their ability to criticize Trump for fake, falsely using emergencies. Exactly likewise, these rescinding of invitations of a perfectly honorable, although we disagree with, with what she's doing, but she hasn't, this is not Kristi Noem. She's not in scandal. She's serving honorably. You disagree, okay. But then you rescind it. It takes away your ability to say that the Trump administration is narrow. And that's exactly what you just said, and I just repeated it.
All right, Dan. But, well, because you said it the first time. Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Media, senior editor and columnist. Dan, be good, and we'll chat next week. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Great.
All right, there you go, Dan Haar. We like to check with this gentleman right around once a month to make sure the fine state of Connecticut is still churning away at doing sometimes imbecilic things and things that don't make sense. Chris Powell joins us, noted columnist and blogger. Mr. Powell, how are you? How you doing, Chris?
Well, I'm not on I-95 this afternoon, so I think I'm doing pretty good.
With thousands of other people yelling at the radio as they hear me bloviate. Yes, but at least...
Torture.
At least we can get 10 minutes of clarity with you. A couple of your recent columns, one that came out a couple of days ago. We still have this notion, Chris, and I talk about this all the time. We still have this notion that somehow, and we understand education needs to be funded, but we have this notion that if we have any problem in education, just throw more money at it, and it's suddenly going to be remedied, which almost never happens.
Yeah, the education lobby is very strong at the Capitol, and they had a hearing the other day. They had lots of school kids who were drafted to come up and say that, you know, we need a lot more money in education. I didn't expect the legislators to put any critical questions to them, but I couldn't help regurgitating some of the critical questions for a column that, you know, would have been nice if they'd put some of the critical questions to the students. You know, students were talking about how we've had a lot of inflation and the schools, you know, have to pay more for this and that. And that's true, but you know, nobody asked them about the steady decline in student enrollment in Connecticut's schools. Shouldn't that be taking some of the pressure off? I think the mayor Danbury was there. He's also the Democratic state chairman, Roberto Alves, and he said, "Well, the schools need more money because they've got all these." What did he call it? Multi-language learners to teach now.
Yeah.
That's the euphemism for illegal immigrant kids. And, of course, you know, the mayor always is a good Democrat. He's a big supporter of illegal immigration. I wish somebody among the kids there had, you know, asked him, you know, how much illegal immigration have we appropriated for in regard to the schools? You know, the illegal immigrant kids are very expensive to educate. We don't have their educational record in most cases, and they require training in English, and so they get behind in the other subjects. How much money has the General Assembly and the governor appropriated for these extra costs? Well, of course, they haven't appropriated anything extra for this. They just give us the illegal immigration and expect that we're going to work the costs into it. Anyway, there were, you know, a dozen questions that the kids could have put to the legislators at this hearing, and the legislators could have put to the kids. And the kids, of course, would have been totally flummoxed about this. They don't, you know, nobody instructed them in, you know, the answers to those questions. They were just told, look, we've had a lot of inflation, so we need a lot more money. I just wish... I just wish critical thinking, critical questions were allowed at these events, but they were, you know, it was just using the kids as props.
Yeah, and you know, Chris, before we get on to your present column, I always ask this on the show. All right, we need more money for education. We already spend 24, 25, 26 grand as a student. So somebody please tell me, I say this tongue-in-cheek, of course, give me the magical number when this all turns around. Is it 28 grand? Is it 30 grand a student? Isn't 35 grand a student? And amazingly, Chris Powell, there's silence on my phone lines when I ask people to say, give me a number where it all gets better, because there's no such thing.
Well, there is some meaningful improvement happening now in the schools in the deep south of all places, where they spend, you know, far less than we do per pupil. But of course, you know, the cost of living down there is a lot lower. But they are having success down there in terms of giving individual attention to kids who can't read, and they're trying to make sure that every kid can read fairly well by the time he gets to third grade. And they're purporting not to advance kids past third grade unless they are adequate readers. And they are getting some results. And, you know, this is a system of accountability down there that contrasts very well with our system in Connecticut, which is just social promotion.
Yeah.
And 2 years ago, the Hartford school system graduated a student who declared that she's illiterate. And why did they do this to me? You know, we were supposed to get investigations of that by the Hartford school superintendent and the state education commissioner. Of course, there's been no investigation. There's been no report. Our system in Connecticut is social promotion. Illiterates can get high school diplomas in Connecticut. In Mississippi, Alabama, they're trying to make sure the kids can read. We're trying to make sure the kids have self-esteem so that when they graduate from high school illiterate, they feel good about themselves.
Yeah, Chris Powell is the guest, finally. Speaking of Chris, of feeling good about oneself, boy, if you're a lawyer, you will love this. We're going to make Connecticut cleaner by instituting some scheme here to claim that the environment is not clean enough for me, so therefore there's legal action here. What is this about?
Yeah, our environmentalists in Connecticut, they want to put a so-called green amendment to the state constitution to guarantee everybody a clean and healthy environment. You know, what does that mean exactly? Well, the amendment wouldn't say. The amendment effectively would just turn environmental policy over to lawsuits and the unelected branch of government, the courts. It would take it out of the hands of the elected officers, the governor and the state legislators. And they might like to have environmental policy taken away from them and given to the courts, because then they could just wash their hands of the controversies and costs of environmentalism and pollution. The environmentalists here want to blame the energy companies for pollution. Their slogan is "Make polluters pay." It's not the energy companies that are polluting. They manufacture the oil and the natural gas. The polluters are you, me,
yes.
Everybody who's stuck on I-95 right now. You want to make polluters pay? Well, we already have taxes on fuels here in Connecticut. And we're already making them pay. We could make them pay more without putting a big tax on the oil companies. But the environmentalists want to scapegoat the oil companies so that they don't have to make people look at themselves in the mirror and decide just how much pollution and climate change possibly is acceptable to them for the progress that conventional fuels bring to their lives. That's the intelligent argument we ought to be having about climate and fuel policy, but we won't have it as long as our policy is just to put a vague green amendment in the Constitution to make those bad polluters pay.
Yeah. Well, you said you used the word intelligent, Chris, and right then and there we had to shut your argument down. Hey, finally, in your latest column, you do mention, let's shift to something tragic, a couple of shootings in Hartford. And again, you and I have talked about this. I've had mental health professionals in my family on some very prominent boards and whatever talking about this. So much of the tragedies that happen when people are shot or wounded by police, the police feeling they have no other way to get out of a situation here, it is sadly because of mental health problems. And still to this day, we don't seem to have the will to really want to do something about this.
Well, if you look into the details of these cases, you'll find that Hartford is really an open-air mental hospital. A couple of years ago, they started this squad of emergency social workers. Social worker squad had something like almost, I think, 2,000 calls for help since it started in 2022 in Hartford. But Hartford recently cut the squad back to save money. The Hartford police say they get hundreds of mental health calls every year. They had almost 2,000 last year. And they said so far this year they had another 341 just in the first 2 months of the year. I don't think most towns in the state have, this kind of mental health crisis going on all the time. There's a lot of mental illness in Hartford, but we don't have mental hospitals anymore. We just say, hey, call the police when somebody freaks out.
Yeah. ChrisPowellColumn.com. That is the website, ChrisPowellColumn.com. Chris, thanks, man. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Be good. Appreciate the time, as always.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it. Right. Big crowds, I guess, from what I hear up at the state capitol today. We told you last week that the latter part of this week, the 11th today, the 12th and the 13th on Friday, going to be a lot of gatherings up there because of public hearings, which is good. And now there's a little bit of controversy because the Democratic majority has cut off the testimony time. All right, listen, not so much that, because if you let everybody, it's just my opinion. I know the Republican majority is upset with this. But if you let everybody speak who wants to speak, you'd be there for days. Nobody would get out alive. There'd be mass people snoring on the floors of the Capitol building if everybody testified. So I get that. I understand that. Plus, here's an idea. I can't say never, but it's a rare time when public testimony changes things. Now, it might this time around, and it might not. But again, here's what I want to lead with today. And I was doing a lot of poking around, getting my thoughts together on this, and reading this as we led into the show today. And again, I'm going to kind of pick up where we left off from the other day, which is this controversy over homeschooling. Now, come to find out, according to the state tally, and there is some sort of a... some sort of a rough estimate here as to how many homeschooled children there are in Connecticut. The low end is about 1,800 and change, around 1,900. So roughly about 2,000 in a state of 3.5 million people. To me, that seems a little low. But what do I know? I'm just a guy that flaps my gums here. On the high end, they're saying, well, it's about 20,000, and that is that's a pretty good number, you would think. If it is, in fact, as high as 20,000, maybe that's as high as a small town. In fact, it would be a small town. So let's just operate from the guise here of starting off here on this midweek Wednesday on Connecticut Today. Did I say it's nice to have you here? It is. What is a fair and equitable way? Because if the state wants it, they're going to get it. And as I offered in some sort of perhaps sage advice or not to people who homeschool out there, if you say no to everything, you're just going to make the problem worse. So what is a, and I find this amazing, that we don't have an accurate count. Other states do, from what I understand. And I know there is an inherent distrust of the homeschooling, or from the, I shouldn't say of, from the homeschooling community or communities toward state government. And there should be a good, healthy mistrust. Fear is life's greatest motivator. There's a good, healthy skepticism we should have. But I guess some of the testimony we're hearing today out of the Capitol is centered around a basic part of this education bill, or what's being called colloquially the homeschooling bill, about letting actual people know here in Connecticut, whether it's in the Department of Education, whether it's your local school board or school district, or whether it's the DCF, Children and Families, letting somebody you know where your kid is being schooled. Now, if you're in the public school system, you and the identifying nature of your kid and family, they're there. They're in the records. Any of you folks, I never went to public school, but any of you folks who, went to a public school, the public school rolls are part and parcel of the public education program of this and every other state. But there is some continued controversy here now as to how you keep an eye on maybe kids that are not just homeschooled. They might be privately schooled, they might be in Catholic school, and the question remains. And there's a lot of, from what I understand, a lot of passionate debate up at the state capitol today. the notion of letting the state know where and how your child is being educated. So what is the best and fairest way to keep an accurate count on how many kids are being homeschooled in the state? Because this is one of the initial parts of this law that's rubbing people the wrong way. And I don't know whether that's justified or not. I'm being honest here. I'm not a kind of guy that's always going to be against everything the state wants. And I don't necessarily think, although I may be reading the bill wrong and being, you know, misinterpreting what people have said to me about this, including guests on this show, I don't think this sounds that egregious to me, but I could be wrong. So we'll pick up on this today. We'll take a quick break here. We'll come back and we'll go over this again as to the idea of how, based on a couple of really bad incidents over the past couple of years with the Mimi Garcia case and with the alleged home captivity of this young man in Waterbury, I guess there were other couple of cases the previous couple of years where officials contend that the specter of homeschooling was not handled properly or reports thereof. But again, we begin with our question of the day. Talk or text 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. What's the best way and the fairest way? Because if you keep saying no, you're going to get something jammed down your throats, rhetorically, of course. What's the best and proper way to keep an accurate count, a fair and accurate count, of how many kids are being homeschooled in the state? And does the state have the right to know that? Some would say, well, they have no right to know where kids are getting educated. Really? Honestly? What do you think? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Pretty busy week up at the state capitol. A lot of bills, a lot of emotionally charged bills. I guess there's a bill today about vaccines. Don't get me started on vaccines. I'm a big believer in vaccines. Now, again, forced vaccination, that's a big thing. But some of the nutty things I have heard about vaccines is just, no, please don't get me started. Anyway, I'll just get in trouble with a bunch of you folks. But homeschooling. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. I ask a simple question here, because there is this homeschooling bill that's being considered in this short section of the General Assembly, and this is not per se, although, now what did I tell you a couple of weeks ago about being careful about curriculum? They may be pushing curriculum here, too, which is a big fat no for me, but we'll get to that later. But one of the early parts of this homeschooling bill that I read, and is a contentious part, is the state wanting to know, and by the way, not just for homeschooling, the state wanting to know how many kids are in private schools. Now, to me, I read that and I said, do you mean they don't know? You mean they don't know, like, how many kids are being homeschooled and privately schooled? And now they're saying, well, they'd have to set up a new framework for that, and they're saying to keep track on it's going to cost $400,000 a year. What? What? But apparently there's a big public hearing up at the Capitol today. In fact, they're going to cut off, I think I was told, public testimony at right around midnight tonight, maybe a quarter after into the early morning on Thursday. But be that as it may, the question remains here, and I think it's a fair question. Does the state have a right, state of Connecticut, because they're claiming they do, Does the state of Connecticut have a legal right to keep an accurate count of how many kids are being homeschooled? Because under this homeschooling bill, you would have to go down to your local Board of Education, board of or school district, if you are removing your child, your son, your daughter, or your kids, children, girls, boys, or whatever mix of gender you might have there, and tell them, hey, we're moving or we're transferring to a private school or a Catholic school, or we're homeschooling. Now, personally, just me, if that's the extent of it, I don't have a problem with that, assuming that they're going to be honest about this. Now, maybe I'm just saying people are too honest here. Maybe I'm too trusting. And maybe their needs, as our buddy Craig Fishbein said, state rep from Wallingford, buddy of mine for years, maybe there's an effort now to rewrite this so it'll please more of the homeschooling crowd there, which, again, I give all the credit in the world to doing. It's not something I don't think I could do. I know people that have done it. They say, hey, they love doing it. Their kids did better than the regular school for whatever the reason. That's not my point here. But the state says that in an answer to this horrible Waterbury situation, in an answer to what happened with Mimi Garcia, and Chris telling us on the news there's been court action in that case today, they want to get a better grip on who's being homeschooled and if, and more importantly, if any of the families or significant others or guardians of these kids, if they've had any encounter with DCF. Is that just the product of learning something from what happened in New Britain and Waterbury and in a couple of cases before that? Or is that being intrusive? It doesn't sound intrusive to me. Well, they're just trying to build a list of who's being homeschooled. Okay. And what would the problem be there? Now, could there be problems? I guess. But people are worried about it. Why? Do they think there's going to be some sort of, you know, state truant officer who's going to go in there and march in there and say, hey, you have to put your kids in school? Maybe. I don't know. Is this a precursor to telling you, hey, we're not going to let you homeschool your kid or kids unless you teach certain things? Which is why people are starting to get a little worried about the name of the bill being an equivalent education bill, which is what I warned you about a couple of weeks ago. And I said, well, what do they mean by equivalent education? If they're teaching, you know, some, you know, if they're bringing in transgender frogs to read poetry in the school down the street, does that mean you have to go on and get your own set of very happy transgender frogs and do the same thing? You know what I mean. I'm being tongue in cheek for a reason. Relax. Come on, you know what I mean. I'm being absurd because a lot of what we talk about here in the news is quite absurd. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Does the state of Connecticut, State Education Department, DCF, does it have, Connecticut, a legal right to keep an accurate count of how many kids are being homeschooled? Because if you ask right now, they're not even sure. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. But one would think the state has a right to know, or maybe they don't. All right, we talked a little while ago about the fluctuation on oil prices today. That has to do with what's going on in the Middle East, the Straits of Hormuz, and all that. From a military perspective now, a purely strategic perspective, how are we doing? We welcome back on issues like this and more our CBS News military analyst, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Jeff McCausland. Colonel, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Yeah, it's Paul. I don't mean to be rude, but actually I was a full colonel and not a lieutenant colonel.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I want to know. No. All right, I'm sorry. I wrote that down. Full colonel, Colonel Jeff McCausland. Colonel, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Paul. It's good, delightful to be with you. I am pretty busy, to say the least.
Today. Yeah. So you see this on a map, Colonel, and you're seeing all this, and what are the commanders looking at right now? What do you see, and what do you think they're seeing and thinking about?
Well, I think they're thinking a couple of things. One is the performance by the U.S. military has been extraordinary in conducting a complex military operation.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, we've had seven service members killed and about 150 injured. And sadly, again, the prospects are in a conflict like this with the level of violence going on, that it's going to get worse. Second of all, they see that the particular conflict is escalating vertically in terms of the targets they're striking, the ordnance they're using. We've now hit over 5,000 targets. And we're
wow.
now using B-1, B-2, and B-52 bombers with heavy loads. Since we've taken out all the air defense, those aircraft can get in pretty safely. And keep in mind, a B-52 can carry 70,000 pounds of bombs.
Jeez.
At the same time, however, our adversary, the Iranians, get a vote on our strategy.
Yeah.
And they are escalating vertically. The conflict now has stretched from Cyprus, where a couple of drones headed towards a UK base, to Sri Lanka, where the United States sank an Iranian naval vessel with a torpedo. First
yeah.
time we've done that since 1945.
Wow.
In the north, it's stretched to Azerbaijan. In the south, it's stretched to Oman. So this whole region now is aflame in a conflict. And while the U.S. military has been conducting and striking those targets and degrading the Iranian ballistic missile capability and their ability ever in future to acquire the material for a nuclear weapon,
mm-hmm.
The question is, to what end? And the problem I think we got, which was probably causing senior leaders to scratch their head, is would somebody please tell me the political objective we're trying to accomplish
mm-hmm.
so I can marry up my military actions to shape a future, which is what we want to do. And that seems to be pretty vague or unclear.
Yeah, Colonel, in this situation now, you've got reports that Russia, I know you probably saw these, Colonel, Russia is, which doesn't surprise me knowing who leads them, but Russia is helping Iran with, I don't know, targeting or strategy. Is there anything the Russians, in your mind, Colonel, could do that we wouldn't sit there and say, well, of course he's doing that. Is this bluster, or could what Mr. Putin and his generals are doing severely harm our forces?
Well, they could, but the most surprising thing about this, in my mind, is that Mr. Witkoff, the senior negotiator with the Russians for President Trump,
yeah.
has said, well, the Russians say they're not doing this, and we can take them at their word. Really? That's what I find surprising. But be that as it may, this is not a terrible surprise, and we should recognize the fact the Russians know that we give targeting intelligence to the Ukrainians. We've been
okay.
doing that for 4 years,
yeah.
which has made them more effective against Russian forces. We know the Russians provided intelligence to the Houthis during our conflict with the Houthis in
okay.
terms of where our ships were located. We know that occurred as well. It was surprising when it became public knowledge that the Russians were providing the same kind of targeting information to the Iranians, whether mm-hmm. they can take advantage of it or not is a secondary question. That in the middle of all that, the president would decide to call Mr. Putin, which seemed to be kind of an odd time to call him when that was just hitting the front pages of American newspapers and our television and sets. But I don't see the Russians being able to provide material assistance much beyond that. That could be important if it, you know, is combined with weaponry and then can actually target one of our ships. Certainly that would be a concern. They may be able to provide some component parts to the Iranians.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is the Russians actually were dependent for a long period of time on drones that were produced in Iran. And
yeah.
they re-engineered that and now produce a drone called the Jenna 2, and they produce about 1 million-plus of those on an annual basis.
Wow.
They
wow.
might be able to provide some of those things to Iran and help them to some degree. But let's face it, the Russians got their hands full in a war in Ukraine, which over the last few weeks, they actually have been losing territory.
Wow. Colonel, final question for you in about the 30 seconds we have left. What am I hearing about we might possibly run out of ordnance? Is that possible or not?
No, I don't think we'll run out of ordnance writ large. Like I said before, now that we've dampened down the air defense, then we can go in with the heavy bombers, and a lot of them are just dropping dumb bombs as opposed to standoff munitions. We got lots of those. The big problem, of course, is interceptors in terms of intercepting ballistic missiles and
yeah.
particularly intercepting drones. And if you fire a Patriot PAC-3 missile at a drone, you're firing a $4 million missile at something that costs $35,000, which is not exactly an exchange rate you want to get into. Now, the Pentagon says we have ample supplies of interceptors. The real problem actually may be that our allies in the region, the Gulf Arabs, Saudis, Emiratis, and others, may run out of interceptors. And all of a sudden, they're defenseless. What's really interesting is now that the Ukrainians actually may become a force in this particular conflict because over time they've developed anti-drone drones to great effect and, in fact, are having conversations already with many of the Arab states in the region to provide those actual killer drones to them at a cost of about $5,000 per drone interceptor.
Amazing. Well, Colonel, thanks. Always great to hear from you. CBS News military analyst, retired Colonel Jeff McCausland. Colonel, thanks. Have a happy day. Appreciate the info. We'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Take care.
All right. There you go.